spiritual dominion, that gave him the material
right.
dominion
gave him
as the firstborn among many brethren.
Yes.
But you would say, in terms of the rights of primogeniture, it means that you have to have spiritual, the firstborn has to be spiritually qualified first before he can receive and dispense of
physical.
The inheritance.
And to that extent, you think about the crossing of the hands and why that was done, where a younger son at a given time was given the birthright rather than the actual oldest son, which would have by law had the birthright. And I think that we're talking about the father knowing that son, that specific son that he gave the birthright to, whether he was the firstborn or the lastborn, he became the first spiritual firstborn. That person came to know the father personally, just like the father before him had. Therefore, his father knew that's the person that would deal correctly with the rest of the siblings and those that were involved with the land, not just some unrighteous person who would take it and greedily squander it, use it for his own personal gain or whatever else.
Right. Yeah, I tend to see the Bible showing the firstborn as being the executor of the father's estate, which would mean he would be distributing the inheritance. And then I suppose lacking a will from the father on the matter, then he would have to either decide on his own accord, or they would have to cast lots to determine who, which of the children got what inheritance.
But still in all, that spiritual connection was needed in order for a father to make a decision that son was righteous enough.
Well, of course, he received the double portion too. You got to remember that.
Right.
And then he had all the other, so even if he didn't have total control over distributing the property, he still had other responsibilities.
We have people believing that they should be in charge of the birthright over all countries right now. Leaders. These men have not spiritually done anything in order to actually sit in the position, but have usurped it illegally against the Father.
Yeah.
And therefore, that's what we're talking about. Whether it's nationwide or on an individual basis, you have to have righteous individuals in order to have it come out right.
Well, to kind of bring everybody else into this discussion, howdy. Let's see if I'm recording here. Yep, I'm recording. I would think so.
By the way, Dad, these kids only have 90 minutes.
But extended play should have doubled it.
No, 90 minutes is on extended play. Yeah.
90 minutes is an hour and a half.
Hour and a half, yeah.
So SLP is standard. No, it's standard long play. Or slow.
Actually, I'm not quite sure. All I know is that SLP is a slow play.
Okay.
Slow play.
So next time we will probably get two.
No, we're not.
You think it's
okay. That's what SLP said. In talking about this session now, if you look at your outline, we are talking about setting up the family abbey, and I wanted to pass these sheets here to everybody. I think there's 10 or 11 copies, so there should be enough for just about everybody, even the young people can have one. And of course, all of this material is finding its way on the website, Family Abbeys, spelled with an E-Y, not just with Y, but E-Y-S. Not for me, might be for you. I don't think for this mic it would be, and that tape is almost out. So anyway, this material here is on the website, but along with a lot of other stuff. And there is a fair amount of controversial material in here, in some people's eyes. People that are very much into the church, into churchianity, have real problems with the idea of family churches or family worship, because they feel like it needs to all happen at church. And in my mind, church is a supplemental kind of thing if you want to get together with other people. But the primary worship should be in the home with the father priest leading his family to God. And there's a transition time also that I see. A young man gets about 20 years of age. He probably has a family of his own then. But I still see him as being a part of his father's abbey until he gets to be about 30. And when he becomes about 30 years of age, it seems like in the Bible, 30 years was when the Levites became priests. And 30 years of age is when Jesus started his ministry and John the Baptist. And so I kind of see 30 as being the age where the man launches out on full spiritual independence for his family, for his own family. By then, he obviously has children of his own, and he's got the maturity and the resources to be able to take care of his family spiritually as well as materially. So I'm seeing that as the transition there. And the in churchianity, you can have somebody that's fresh out of seminary, like maybe 25 years old, that's the pastor of a 2,000 member church. That's the kind of thing that can happen, and I've seen it happen. If the fellow is well connected with the church hierarchy, so he becomes a spiritual leader, whether he has the maturity for that sort of thing or not. It's all in the head knowledge. It's whether he's got the head knowledge and whether he can do the rituals or not. And if he can do that, then he gets promoted. A lot of churches like to have house groups. Or they call them cell groups, or they might even call them house churches, or they might encourage family devotions. But what I'm talking about is nothing like that. I'm talking about autonomy, spiritual autonomy for the family. And that's something that's really frightening to church groups, because they like to think that you are just connected to the mother church, you see, with this umbilical cord, and that they still have control. See, that's the key to all of this, is who has control. And a lot of church organizations are interested in the control. And, of course, the government is interested in the churches having control, because the government can control the churches. You know, if they want something from the church, they can demand it, and usually the church will do what they want them to do. So when this mark of the beast or whatever comes along, you've seen all the compromises that the churches have already made with the state on questions. Like, for instance, there was one church that the federal agents came in and confiscated the church because they didn't take federal withholding taxes, Social Security taxes, from their employees. The church employees that were working in the church didn't take their taxes and refused to do it. They refused to do it for the government. And so the government came and just took everything. That was Pastor Greg Dixon of the Indianapolis Baptist Church about 5 or 6 years ago, when the so-called Christian Assembly of God, Son of Assembly of God preacher, Christian Attorney General John Ashcroft became the Attorney General. That all happened under his watch. So you can imagine what would have happened under Janet Reno had she still been the Attorney General. We all know what she did to one church group a few years before that. So the thing is, the churchianity thing is the government still wants control over the church. And, well, it wants control over everything, but it seems like we have a larger sphere of freedom in the families.
It's out.
Okay. Now, as we're looking, one of the things I needed help with was just in completing this book. Now, it seems to me what I've done in this book, okay, at the beginning I introduced, I talked a little bit about the Celtic abbeys, and then I launched out into a discussion of this idea of, does the Father really have the right to administer the sacraments? Does he really have the spiritual authority or not? And I engage in argument with Gary North, who is a Presbyterian Reformed theologian, and it's coming at it from that angle. From the point of view of conservative mainline Protestantism. I don't know how the Mormons would react, or how the Jehovah's Witnesses would react, or how the other groups would react. I'm engaging with the Protestants on this issue. I already know how the Catholics will react to it. They're pretty well defined as far as their attitude. The church, the one church, the only true church that will get you into heaven. And so so I'm not even engaging with the Roman Catholics on this question. So I follow through on that, and hopefully I've done a good enough job. And then I get to the section where I start talking about later on, and I start talking about the abbey defined. That would be on page 69 there. Oh, one of the things that I got in bold print there, one of the arguments of Gary North is that he keeps arguing and saying, and of course he's arguing against R.J. Rushdoony, who's another Reformed Presbyterian theologian who I don't need to necessarily explain to you who he is, except he was from an Armenian background. If you know the Armenians, they're very family-oriented, and I think that's where he got his views on this question. It was from them. But he keeps arguing that the man gets his priesthood on... He's trying to say that the people that advocate the father-priest idea, that we are saying that the man gets that authority from the marital relationship, okay? And I'm saying that we don't. The marital relationship does not create the right of priesthood for the man. On page 60, I say... No, it's not on 60, I say it. Just a minute. I'm trying to point out the page to you here because I know you need to be able to reference it later. I talk about close. Yeah. Here we go. Okay, page 44, actually, way back. It is not the marital family which holds the keys of the kingdom. This is at the bottom of the page. Rather, it is the dynastic family, specifically the family of the covenant. The dynastic patriarchal family was perpetuated through procreation and ordination. And then I gave, of course, the example of the sons of Jacob there. So, it's not through the marital covenant bond that creates that priestly right. It's through the dynastic succession from father to son in the covenant line through which that priesthood is passed down. That would be what I would argue that that is also supported by the Ten Commandments. The fifth of the Ten Commandments saying, honor thy father and thy mother. It doesn't say, honor thy pastor and thy mother. It doesn't say, honor thy preacher and thy mother. It says, honor thy father and thy mother. And which also means, as I believe, that the mother has a priestly responsibility in conjunction with the father as well. Now, we would expect to see the fathers being the primary dispensers of divine grace in the home, but certainly lacking that, the mother then is obligated by the fifth commandment to step in and to be the priestess in her home. It's my opinion. So this is, I think, is an important distinction to make. And then that's when I get into, on page 48, the failure of American religion, fathers versus preachers. I don't really, I just approach this from the mainline Protestant evangelical groups, the point of view, and I don't focus on the different other religious denominations that have arisen since then, who may or may not have a better grasp on these subjects than the Protestants do. But since our society is probably predominantly influenced by Protestantism still, that's the group that I went after. Let's see. So then on page 68, is that where I said the Abbey defined? 69. Okay, then I start launching out into this idea of trying to define what an abbey is. And of course, we talk about fatherhood. And we try to pattern ourselves after the kingdom of God, because God is a father. So we try to follow his example. I talk about Abraham. And I talk about the fact of, is it necessary for us to have children in order to have an abbey? And because Abraham was an abbot, was the leader of an abbey, and he had 300 servants, you recall, but he had no offspring, at least at the time that he was functioning as an abbot. So my thought on that is that even though Abraham didn't have any children of his own, he was still qualified to be an abbot, because these servants that he had were the descendants of the families that had covenanted with his father. And he inherited these people, the custodianship and the guardianship of these people. He inherited all of that from his father. And so he had to be their abbot as part of the responsibilities of inheritance. And then, of course, later, Abraham began to have children of his own. And then this same entourage was passed on to Isaac, you recall. These same groups of people. But I don't see them being passed on to Jacob. I don't know what happened to these people. When you have 300 men in your household that can wield a sword, you're talking about thousands of people potentially here. And certainly by the time of Jacob, it could be tens and thousands of people that you're talking about. I don't see those people going down to Egypt with Jacob. So they must have gone with other members of the family, presumably, or off on their own and started their own abbeys, perhaps. See, this is the thing that's neat about the abbey system, is you're always looking to colonization and succession. You're not trying to lock everybody up into this one little group, or big group, whatever, where you're under the control of one man. You're always looking at propagating, and you're looking at people growing up and forming their own abbeys and continuing the process as you're growing out. So there's a period of control, and then there's a period of relinquishing. control over people. Then I discussed what is a family. Again, some really controversial stuff on that because we bring up the issue of polygamy. And there's this raises another question. Can a person, if a person can be the head of an abbey without any children, can he be the head of an abbey without being married?
Just a single guy.
A single guy.
And you're just stepping
Okay, he says, Josiah says, then we're just stepping back into Catholicism. And he's right, in a way, isn't he? Because you're really getting into a monastic environment, perhaps.
Well, Isaac did for a while before he married Rebecca.
Okay, so you think...
You said all of those people went with Isaac, and Abraham sent them away. So, for a while he was.
But wasn't
he was
Isaac,
like 60 when he had his children.
Wasn't Isaac already introduced and had from his father certain blessings that he had already been given? His father having knowledge beforehand from God or revelation that his son would fulfill this, completing the covenant. Therefore, he was already in the covenant, even though he hadn't taken certain steps yet that would say he was married. He was already, it was already known, obviously, it would seem to me, that he was going to be by revelation to his father. Or I don't think his father ever would have put him in the position or anointed him to that. And obviously there had to be anointings and blessings given at a prior date. I'm sure that was done long before he took Isaac even up to the supposed sacrifice. And the fact that Isaac was willing to accept himself as being the sacrifice, knowing beforehand, actually, from most accounts that I know, he knew and was willing to place himself under his father's total jurisdiction and trust in his father, which was part of the requirement on him in order to know where his heart was at. Having said that, he was already in the covenant.
So what you're saying is, or I could say in another way, there was a stated mission or goal that was clearly defined that they were striving for. It wasn't, we couldn't say that it was a stated doctrine, that it was okay for us to be A, childless, and B, unmarried, for us to have an abbey, because... Abbey presupposes there's a father, right? The Abba father concept.
Although it couldn't have been any of the other sons. Abraham knew it had
it
to be Isaac or not at all.
It was him
He's
because...
God appointed it, but it had to be Isaac.
Because, it comes, like you said, it comes back to your spiritual qualifications. Is that what you're getting
and
at?
And the knowledge the father had, as well as his father in heaven knew... And it had to have been revealed to both of them by the Holy Ghost, as I see it. In other words, they already had the burning within sight to know the direction. They followed the directive, which was keeping the commandments, knowing that he would keep the commandments. He was already ordained to the position.
Okay. Now. So why would it be so important that we have a physical propagation here of the abbey by the abbot?
Two things.
Okay.
One, experience.
Okay. Okay.
One could not really act like a father without being a son, for one thing. Isaac was absolutely, impeccably acting like a son should act. That was a part of the equation built up to where they were going with what was happening within that patriarchal structure.
Okay. I need a pen, please. Thank you.
Continue. Secondly, being under covenant, he would have had to have been a priest, maybe not a high priest yet, but at least a priest in the sense of what a high priest is, like Jesus Christ coming to the position of being a high priest to fulfill not only the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law, and have the qualifications in order to fulfill the position. A high priest could not do that. He couldn't be a high priest without having a wife, at least one, and propagation. That was part of the requirements, okay, as I understood. Even Jesus Christ fulfilled that.
According to my doctrine, yes.
Well, not just according to yours. Yours may be more pertinent to the point and with more more knowledgeable structure that you've pulled out of the hidden places, you know, pulled it out, and now you've shown it to people. But there are scholars that knew that long ago, even though they would not want to voice it too loud out there. The point was that Isaac, it had already been determined, and who he married may have already even been determined. The marriage may have been much like between Joseph and Mary when that marriage was set. The first one, which was a pre-marriage, but no physical contact till the final marriage took place.
Now, well, let's expand on this a little bit. What would be wrong with the idea, we know the Bible teaches the law of adoption, so what would be wrong with a person simply adopting someone to be your son? And that the Abbey could be succeeded by abbots that are, by fathers that are father to son that are through adoption rather than by physical procreation. You know where the Bible talks about adoption, right? So have we thought about that? See, this is where we get into the theology of the church, because the theology of the church says it's not important to propagate yourself physically, it's the spirit that matters, okay? And so adoption is more spiritual, you have more unity spiritually, see?
Okay. If one is spiritual, they will follow the dictates of that spirit which they follow, whether it be of the devil or of God. And if they follow the spirit of God, then they would do the things of God and do the things of Abraham. What things did Abraham do? It was in the doing that he showed his faith.
Well, yes, and if you follow the logic of what we talked about in the last session, if we believe there's a conspiracy out there to destroy the human race, then the false spirit would teach you, let's not propagate ourselves physically, let's propagate ourselves spiritually. That's more pleasing to God to go through this route of adoption and discount the physical side as being less spiritual. That would be what the spirit of Antichrist would suggest, would it not? Because it would diminish the population to such a point, if everybody followed that logic, eventually there would be no human beings left, would there?
Well, specifically to the covenant. What is it? What was the covenant to Abraham? In thy seed the ends of the earth would be blessed.
Okay.
It did not say in somebody else's seed or through them or through adoption or through anything else. It said through thy seed. That was very specific and has to be taken very literally. It can't be taken, I mean, if you want to go to all kinds of ideas outside of simplicity, we can work up all kinds of things. But when you take the Lord literally at his word, which we should, we can only say, you're not in the covenant unless you're part of the seed.
Basically,
period.
Basically, it's the same as royalty. You cannot become like a king if you're adopted. You have to have the actual bloodline connecting yourself to that family.
Well, that, of course, is why there was always a rivalry between the church and the various royal houses of Europe, because those were two conflicting doctrines.
And as the saying went, blood's thicker than water.
Right, blood is thicker than baptismal water.
God had a bloodline all the way down, where he'd call out this one and that one, and he'd keep on down until he got the one he wanted for Jesus to be born with Mary. He had a timeline, and that is why Abraham was so old when he had his son. There was a timeline and a bloodline, but God had everything figured out, and so it would be important to consider that.
And consider it in what way? That it's dispensational, that its use is past, that it's of no relevance anymore? Or are you saying that this was a pattern for us to follow?
More the latter, but I understand that in the world we live right now, people don't know what their bloodline really is. But okay. I think that God knows the bloodline and the timeline, and it's still important to him. So it would have to be important to us if we could discover it and follow it.
Yeah, I would say that, as I've tried to argue in my book on hierogamy, that Jesus, it wasn't enough for Jesus to be manifested in the spirit, he had to be manifested in the flesh as well. The covenant embraces the spirit and it embraces the flesh. So what I would say and argue then, that the idea of an abbey is, it's a promise of unity, not of people. It's people coming together who have a unity of spirit to become united according to the flesh as well, you see. So the families, if you have family groups that are coming together or persons that are coming together, it is the promise or the belief that in time, either those individuals or their descendants will intermarry so that they become one flesh as well as one spirit. Because we see then that, as you tried to say with this thought on the seed encompasses spirit and flesh, and you can't have the one without the other. So this is one of the essential features that I see in an abbey, and I see all the other stuff as play acting. You know, you have a lot of religious groups out there that have these communes, and they have these campgrounds, and you have these communities that they all set up, and it's because they want to get people together of like mind. Yeah, that's good that you can be of like mind, but what's the goal in all of this? Is this that we can enjoy each other's company, or is there a goal of creating a new people out of that like-mindedness, you see? And so the idea is that these families would come together, and then over the course of time, of generations if need be, then the families mingle together and they become a one people. There's that unity that's created from that. It is the fruition. If they truly were of like mind, it will bear the fruit of unity in the flesh. That would be how I would see as an essential feature of an abbey. You have a thought? Okay. You're just tracking. Okay. So then, this is why I interject the idea that that's why, in my mind, marriage is essential to the success of an abbey. If, you're just starting, one family group is starting out, it's essential to have a real family that you have the one flesh relationship. And that is also why, one reason why, when you look at the Bible, you see that God surrounds himself with a host. The man who is the leader of the abbey, if he is indeed the leader of the abbey, that is why polygamy has to be an option, because that is a part of his responsibility of propagating that covenant line that he represents. Now that's how I see it. Now, can an abbey exist without polygamy? I think it can. Can it exist without a person being married? I think it can for a while. Can it exist without there being offspring? For a while.
All of those three for a while.
For a while, that's right. But eventually, it's too fragile, and you can't have the continuity to the next generation. Because all you need to do to see what would happen to an abbey is if you didn't have polygamy, and if you didn't have marriage, and you didn't have children, just look at our culture now, and you would end up with the same thing. An abbey would just become another Roman Catholic monastery or Roman Catholic nunnery. That's what eventually it would become.
And all three of those things were tenets that the Roman Catholic Church pushed, was monogamy, you know, each one of those things against the real thing. Monogamy, the second and the third thing too, all of them. I mean, eventually you could just take anybody in, have them be celibate, and they could end up running the whole show.
Exactly.
I mean, that's just
and it happens
absolutely
all the time. Yeah.
And that would be Satan's doctrine. Why don't we just have a bunch of, you know, celibate or homosexuals running the whole show?
Exactly. I think you have something.
He already said what I was going to say, so.
Well, I think that was a play acting on their part, too. I don't think that they did without sex, and I think there were babies born, and
well, we
I don't think, I think that was all just a show front.
Well, I think you're probably right.
That's why the nuns wore habits.
To hide the pregnancy.
To hide their pregnancy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And for the sacrifices.
Okay,
that
you know
from
these
that.
Things.
That came from that.
I had a great great aunt who got pregnant by a priest, and she was a nun, and they ended up killing her.
Killing your aunt?
Great great aunt.
Your great great aunt?
About 100 years ago.
And they killed her for it.
Well, she wouldn't keep her mouth shut.
Oh, okay.
She wouldn't keep her mouth shut.
Okay, so what? So then when we talk about, we'll move on from the family, and I talk about the family of heaven, and let's see, I try to define the family. I get into the subject of polygamy at the end, and that's kind of where I leave it. So then I thought that to finish this book, I needed to talk about Bible prophecy, which is what I talked about this morning. So I really need to write either a chapter or something that tries to take this and kind of shows, you know, what's happening in terms of world history and why this would be important in world history. And then Kay felt I need to add a chapter in there on teaching people how to do it. How to have an abbey, what would be my idea on that. And then I thought that maybe this material that I just handed out to you on the abbey roster, where I talk about the five indicia required of abbeys, that you have a leader, a doctrine of succession, a ministry of helps, a mission statement, and a place to live and worship. Those were the five things that I saw were essential. Now, if you have any suggestions of something that I might have overlooked...
Would you go back to the legal considerations?
We can go back to there after we talk about this, because we're in structure and goals right now. it looks like to me to start at Abby, you got to have a leader, and you need to have a definition of who's doing what in the Abbey, and you need to have a doctrine of succession, so that if somebody dies or quits, you got a plan of action so you can keep the Abbey going. You need a mission statement. Now, this idea of a mission statement will have some bearing on the legal considerations. You remember earlier this morning when I talked about that the abbeys were when the clans devoted, instead of making a contribution like we do with churches today where we give weekly donations to the church, what they would do is they would just donate a piece of land for the people that wanted to be the Christian workers, and whatever they were able to produce from that land is what supported the mission, whatever the mission might have been. If it was copying scrolls, or if it was, growing herbs for the midwives, or sending missionaries somewhere to save the Vikings, or whatever the mission statement of that abbey was, it was the goal was to fund it from what was grown from that piece of land. So being able to define a mission statement, I think, is important. You want to take care of the people that are living on it, but you want to have something that's part of the bigger picture, or what you think your contribution is to the kingdom of God, which of course would require some prayer and some soul searching. Then, of course, a place to live and worship. So you got to buy land in order for this to happen. Now, as I said before, as on the website, I'm very inclusive with the family abbey idea, because everybody, basically anybody, can form an abbey if they want to. Gay people can form an abbey if they want to, but like you said, it will work for a while.
How long will it go on?
Just till AIDS takes them down,
I suppose. But the family, all religions, all races of mankind have families, and so the idea of the abbey is trying to get to enlarge this definition of the family. So then, recruitment and commitment and covenant, that's why I want to set up an institute for family abbeys, so I can bring people here. If this is where I end up having it, which is probably where it will be, bring people here to teach them about the abbeys, teach them some practical skills, give them an opportunity to meet people so that they could go out as groups and start their own abbeys. That's kind of my vision of what I want to do. That's how I have defined it so far. We'll see how it works. Some people could use websites to recruit people that want to do it. Or it could just simply be one family abbey propagating itself and sending out their offspring to form their own abbeys with people that they know from other abbeys and say they start their own. So there could be different ways of doing this. Okay, you want to talk about legal considerations. The thing that I'm looking at here is most people, in most people's minds, an abbey is considered an auxiliary organization of the church. So I'm not legally, I don't see an abbey standing alone. I see a need, where what a person would want to do, as I see it, is they would need to start a church, and then the church would sponsor the abbey. And then the abbey would basically absorb the church, but the church, the facade for interaction with the state, the church would interact with the state, but the real life, the real spiritual life, and the real power would be in the abbey. That's that way you keep a historical continuity with churchianity until we can get to a point in time when people, everybody realizes that the abbeys are the alternative to church. So I see this as a transition phase, and that would be the purpose of setting something up like that. Now, you don't need to be a part of my church so that you can start an abbey. As far as I know, anybody can start a church, and then you can start your abbey. See? So then what were some of the other things?
James. Under a 508 or a 501?
I personally wouldn't care. I mean, it's whatever the people want to do.
But what I'm saying is, from your experience and knowledge about differences between 501s and 508s, which one and why, or do you even know?
Well, the 508s, of course, is talking about churches, which are automatically exempt from taxation. But I don't think you can get a tax ID number for a church unless you declare yourself as a 501c3. So if you're wanting to operate as other businesses operate, you'd want to do 501c3. Now, are you asking me that? Obviously, well, you don't need my input on this.
No, but I'm just, you know, I've heard 508 does not have on it as many heavy-handed realities as a 501c3 does. That's what I've heard. Whether true or not, when you get right down to the nitty-gritty, one of them's going to be better than the other for some reasons. And how that fits with what the Abbey is doing and how that all plays into there.
My opinion changed on that when Indianapolis Baptist Bible Church got taken over by federal agents.
Was that 501?
That was not a 501. That was an unincorporated church. And that was a 508. And they thought that they thought they were clean in that respect. So the conclusion I came to at the time is that if you have a church and you try to act like a church, it's like a duck, you know. If it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, then it must be a duck. The government came to that conclusion. In my mind, you form your church as the facade. There's little to no activity that the church actually does. So there's no money, there's no employees, nothing. The real activity is the abbey. And then, so it's not walking like a duck, it's not quacking like a duck. It's not even a duck. But they have this straw man over here that's their duck, and they can tax that duck all they want. But I don't know if my idea is going to work or not. But I just see it as I'm moving towards the family in terms of, you know, even the taxes, because there's more freedom for families in that area than there are even for churches.
Yeah. Finally a good use for the straw man.
Yeah, finally a good use for the straw man.
Well, all of that comes into play if in fact you're doing business as, and you, each of the children are running under Social Security. However, if you're not doing business as, and you don't have children under those Social Security, they're not even under any of all of that anyway.
Right.
It doesn't have anything to do with them.
Well, I have discovered, if a child doesn't have a Social Security number, then for all practical purposes, to the IRS, they don't exist.
They don't exist, that's right.
They will never be taxed their whole life.
Even if they had a number, if they never used it.
If
they wouldn't be taxed.
The child,
yeah.
if the child, well, from what we understood too, it actually never comes into play until the child actually uses his signature on some document with that number. When they throw that number onto that document, it becomes a legal paper with that signature. Until the child signs it, they could be 35 years old, and the Social Security thing, even if they had a number, means nothing, because there's no activity and there's been no response. The person has not ascribed into that.
Can they send them out of the country if they decide they're an alien and they can't
no,
be here?
No, what you do is you go and get your... We've made birth affidavits for our children showing they were born in the country, and none of that except for going down to the local courthouse, which has no Social Security attached to it, and simply registering it. We have proof that our children were born here in America and are citizens.
Will they accept that for the sake of a passport?
Yes. Oh. Yes, because it's a legal document. I can go down to the court and get a certified copy of a legal document.
Okay. Right. I was told that they could ship me out if I get rid of my Social Security number, tell them I don't want it anymore and stuff, that they could just...
Well, the thing is, technically... Now, see, we're getting into the realm of what happens when they start having concentration camps. Because they can basically take the peasants or the vagabonds who don't have a name or a number on their person, they're undocumented workers, they could take and round them up and put them in a concentration camp because they're undocumented. But where are they going to send them? They can't send them to another country, so they would have to send them to probably work camps, I guess, would be what I would imagine. That's why, in my mind, it's important that we're able to own land, because if you own land and have title to land, you cannot be dispossessed.
But does the Abbey have to pay the land taxes?
If they want you gone, they'll plant marijuana on the property and say that you did it.
Well, when we get to...
Although, if you have a full family Abbey there, sorry for interrupting.
Well, when you go back to those employees of that church, just for that, if they had been just volunteers and the church had paid their rent and stuff like that another way and hadn't given them money, maybe they cooked at the church every day and they ate at the church, and that would Social Security taxes come into play?
Well, yeah, because I think the limit is $90 or something like that, or $300 or whatever.
$400.
$400. And most people... Even if everything is paid for them, they need some cash for little things.
Not if they lived on
$100 a year.
They would have to have less. They have to make less than $400 a year.
I don't. Not if they lived on the Abbey land. And had their rent. You know,
maybe if they'd
workers.
Taken the vows of poverty or something like that.
I think gold and silver comes into it here. If you pay someone a $20 gold coin, that's equivalent to, you can buy $500 worth of stuff with it.
Yeah, that's if you can get somebody to give you 500 ferns for your $20 coin. But they always, you're starting to record those transactions now, too.
Well, the Knights Templar were very rich. They had a lot of, they were all under a vow of poverty, you notice. And they had lots of things.
There's got to be a way to figure that out. Let's back up a little bit there to recruitment and commitment and covenant, because there were a couple of things that I wanted to talk about there, and that was marriage. Marrying the younger members of the Abbey. And this is an issue, you know, that I pray about a lot for my children, and I'm sure that you folks do for your children. And that is that they can marry someone that's compatible to them, that would be at the same level of covenant commitment, rather than some, you know, for instance, taking a homeschool person and marrying them to a public school graduate. Do you see much unity going on there? Probably not. And I've even thought about the fact that now we're discussing these matters of the Social Security number, the hospitals if you have your baby born at the hospital, they will automatically give your child a social security number. So you would have to marry someone that would want to have a home birth, or at least a birth in a midwife's clinic, so that you wouldn't have to run that risk of having your children become wards of the state.
The problem I've had, and this is what I do with people when I do birth form, I will tell them right up front, I don't do birth certificates. I will not sign an application for you to get one, or a social security number. You have to go do it on your own. Either your husband or somebody else who's present at the birth.
That's good.
Because I don't want my signature on any form.
That's because that, and then you become an agent for the state, don't you?
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of, in some states, they want you to be participating in that kind of thing. And I kind of got to the point where I don't even want to be versed with people unless they're good friends, like family, because there's too many legal problems you can get into with people out there.
Yeah.
Basically, we're coming back to the time of Pharaoh and what he told the midwives to do.
Right, and I read that book, and it's like, oh yeah, it's all there. He's been there for a long time.
Yeah. Again, and this is the satanic desire to destroy the human race, right? First he destroys the covenant line, and then he's going to destroy the whole human race. He's already got them. They're, you know, one generation away from mental insanity.
Well, it's not just having a child in the hospital and getting a number, is they subject him to all those vaccinations and, you know, hepatitis B and all these wonderful things.
And the new stuff that they're inventing.
24 hours old, you know?
The avian flu virus or whatever they want to. And I need to back up just a little bit, because some of you might not be aware of some of these things. Historically, for the eons of time, the way you marked the slave, your slave, was is that you either tattooed him or you branded him. So a mark of a slave is what we're talking about here. We're talking about slavery. And when the slaves were set free after the Civil War, most of them went up to Washington, D.C., because that was the only place they could go where the government had jurisdiction to give them any money to help them. See, all the other country was under state government, but there in Washington, D.C., that was the federal government, and that was as far as the federal government had the power to go to help people. So that's why today 90% of the population of Washington, D.C. is black people, because they are the descendants of slaves that came up from the South and went to Washington, D.C. Well, they had this massive migration of black people into the nation's capital, and they had to do something about it, so they set up what was called the Freedmen's Bureau. And the Freedmen's Bureau was the ones that passed out the money and the food and helped the black people get started. And of course, some of them went ahead and left and went to other parts of the country, but they were dependents on the federal government. In the 1930s, the Freedmen Bureau changed its name. You want to know what the name of that is? It's called the Social Security Administration. So when people took the Social Security number, thinking it was great, they were changing their status from being free men to becoming dependents or wards of the federal government. Now you children are, most of you are still young enough to know what it means to be a ward, because you have parents that can tell you what to do and what not to do. You are dependent on your parents. Well, when you form that relationship with the government, you create a dependency on the government. And so this is a status issue that we're talking about here. And that's why if you have the Social Security number, theoretically, you become a national asset, a human resource, and they can use you as they see fit. They can send you off to a war, or they can take you for some other national task that they have, some work thing that needs, they could draft you for anything, essentially. So I'm just I didn't want to leave any gaps there. I wanted you to understand the history involved in all of this. Yeah.
What do you know as far as drafting females at this point? Are they into doing that?
Well, there was an uproar a couple of years ago over... There was a proposal on the table for that, but I don't think it went anywhere. I don't even think they have to register, do they? Or maybe do all 18-year-olds have to register, or just males?
That's what we were wondering.
It doesn't say on the document if it was changed.
What does it say?
It doesn't say what gender you have to be.
Okay.
I remember when I went to get my license renewed, they slapped that document in front of me, and I said I wouldn't sign it.
What did they say?
They said, okay. They just gave me my license and say that if you wear that, you can go to prison and be fined to, I think, what was it, $250,000? So they gave me a warning, though. I'm not going to be too worried about it.
Well, it looks like this Ministry of Helps is similar to what I'm thinking of as a volunteer group. They're living on the Abbey, and they have these different ministries of healing and the school and Minister of Instruction and then something about arms, Minister of Arms, and that. So you gave them a ministry title, and then I suppose you have some people that are the Ministry of Growing the Food or something, and then that's how they can live on the Abbey grounds and eat and have shelter and heat and everything. So that's just the way they can get around the monetary amount that they would need, because they could barter and go under the cover of the Abbey. Is what I'm looking at is how much cover can the Abbey give to the people that are on it.
That's why we need someone to become a lawyer.
But he planned to get rich.
Yeah.
We all need to become lawyers.
Yeah.
Yeah, to a degree. One legal issue is, where do we stand right now in the time of prophecy? There are two different statuses. One, we are in our own land, and the oppressor is coming, and we should fight the oppressor. Then there's the second state where we've already gone into captivity, in which case we should just be good, humble slaves, but work our butts off to build houses and have lots of children. So what point are we at now? Are we at the point where we circle the wagons and fight off the invaders, or do we just bow our heads and get on with living until the slavery ends?
I think there's still a lot of room for evasion.
Escape route.
Yeah, I think, and as long as there's still room for evasion.
Even though we are occupied, and even though we have been put under the classification of slaves, and we have to, so to speak, stay behind the scenes with what we do, we have to be careful about what we do. But we prepare for the worsening of it, knowing that it's not time to rise up. There is some scripture which states that slaves will rise up against their masters. However, that point is not... Most of the slaves are very happy selling their drugs and having their fine cars to drive right now. They're not at a point where they're going hungry out roaming in the countryside with nothing. I mean, they haven't got the people to that point. So, for the most part, most of the slaves are just happy. We're not very happy about it. However, we're not going to jump up and down and scream and holler very much. It's not time yet.
Yeah, and also, too, I think that the powers that be, there's still people that want to leave loopholes for people like us because we're still a formidable foe.
Yes.
Or at least we seem to be, in their minds, a formidable football foe. We can still homeschool. Mm-hmm. We can still home birth. But they're trying their best to make it difficult for us to do that. We don't have to have Social Security numbers, but they're trying to make it difficult for us to make a living. with those social security numbers. So what we do is we pray and rely on God to bless our strawberry patch, see, deal in cash or whatever we can do, and try to avoid unnecessary entanglements with having a career or trying to have, you know, owning a business that is too entangled with the system, where you have employees and all of that, where you have to get involved in all of their legal ramifications.
That's why the family, Abby, is key. But you could have a million Abbeys, and economically it would become stressful to the economists. Just, we would, if we became self-sufficient, wasn't doing enough with the economy. So this generation needs to kind of still play with the economy, but your children, if you can free them under the Abbey where they can live a different life, then they're not going to be so noticed right away. But they have to leave everything kind of open right now until they get all the gay issues and everything out there. They can't come down strict until they get some of that stuff that they want to get through. So it's really a matter of time before they start. It'll mean something to them, because there's just a certain percentage of the economy goes down and people aren't buying. It's like a pyramid that's built on that will crash down if there's enough consumers. And so the best thing for the next generation is for this generation to do the little play game, I guess, with still working and paying some taxes and that, but let the next generation go in under the cover of the Abbey.
Yes. We're already slaves, but if we can buy freedom for someone else, we do it. And when there's enough of us, we too.
Well, I want to get back to this area of recruitment, commitment, and covenant. And it all ties in together. Evangelism, outreach. What kind of plan should we have for these things? I know you guys, for instance, have your commitments already, but I'm not sure what kind of approach I should take, whether I should be high profile or whether I should be low profile. I'm low profile, recruitment would be pretty slow, and that's been the way it's been for a long time because it's been low profile. But I could go high profile. I can hire a public relations firm and get my name out in the newspapers pretty easy and start generating. You know, think about it. You know, the word Abbey has kind of a cuddly sound to it. You know, Abbey sounds comforting to a lot of people. The family Abbey. It could be a good seller in terms of recruitment.
If you want to sell books, yes. If you want to sell the idea, that's the way to go. As far as bringing people into this Abbey, I've been finding with my own internet outreach, every so often I'll get people emailing me and saying, wow, cool information. I don't hear from them again. It's like, you know, they take what they need and they are on their own path. You know, the only real solid growth seems to come by word of mouth. And I've been moving away from technology because I'm realizing a lot of our problems are, we are scattered so far apart. We're moving too fast, sitting around these automobiles. We don't have time to stop and talk to each other and actually form communities, which is, that's what the Abbeys are for, but at some point we do have to find someone that's moving at a slower pace, bring them in, or slow someone down, bring them in, and then there's a multiplier effect where, you know, if each person is doing that. So it's about not just one man doing evangelizing, but training everyone to do the evangelism to bring it in. I've noticed every successful group, everyone feels like, wow, we're a part of this, and here's a simple way to help build. Oh, hey, I'll invite my friend. Hey, come here. We're having this really cool get-together. And that way things grow. Some people will say, well, not for me, and they'll leave. But other people will say, I like this, and they'll stick around. So you invite them back. And so if you look at how the apostles did, they didn't have our modern technology, but they didn't just send out letters. They went and they talked in the synagogues, they talked to people in person. And when they found enough of an interested group, they separated them so they weren't getting hammered from every side by the opposers. But they picked out the medium grade ore and then they refined it until they had a pure ore.
So you're saying the institute idea might be not a good idea?
Oh, no, I think it's a good idea. I'm just saying, again, you do need some advertising. If people are going to hear about you by word of mouth, then they're going to want to look you up. They'll say, well, let's find out who this is. So it's like took a sales order company, they have their catalog. It's not a direct sales thing. You can mail out 100 of them, maybe 1 in 1,000 will buy from it, but then again, people hear about, hey, there's this company writing for the catalog and send it, then they'll order from it. It's important to have the catalog, but it's not your main sales tool.
Okay.
Crying in the wilderness has been the plea of all the prophets directly in proportion to the wickedness in the land. For you to cry in the wilderness and say, you know, we're setting up family abbeys, this is what can be done, here's how to do it, that sort of thing, is good. However, you notice that when they cried in the wilderness, most of the people didn't come. Most of the people actually fought against them. What I would think, even though crying in the wilderness, especially if God has given you that edict, you've got to do it. But at the same time, preparing for the time when they're in trouble and they're ready to accept what's been set in motion. The thing that's set in motion may not be very big yet in amount of number of people, right? But it is the basis upon which you're hoping or expecting a great outgrowth, because this is collapsing and this is going to be built up. The Lord said, make high things low and low things high. Okay? The key to the success is preparation by example ahead of time. Just do it. If it succeeds, people will see that, and as their world is collapsing, they will jump on the bandwagon. Meanwhile, the things that you've prepared ahead of time already, such as the book or the books, I think those kinds of things should go high profile. As long as they're low profile, you get one or two here now and then. If the Horogamy book could go high profile, bring the price down to a place where people could afford it, typical of what's out there, let it just sell. Do it, but let it be the sounding board for the flack that's going to come. Not the abbey as the flack that's going to come. Protect the abbey, protect what you're doing. Let something else sit out there as either the fodder or the whatever it's going to be.
So what do you think then about the idea of the Family Abbey website?
Oh, I think that's a great idea.
Okay.
I think that's a good idea. Fine, it can be put out there because it's not in and of itself a threat to anybody. All it can be to those who look it up on the internet or find it or are told about it, basically to them it's simply something to look into. Some of them will go away, some may come in. But overall, not many are going to come in because that hasn't collapsed yet. You follow that?
Right.
Until that collapses, this idea is not going to be 0.1%, if that. It's just not going to be, period. It's when that world is totally falling apart completely that they're going to go, oh my gosh, yes. And well, that's when what started in the grassroots aspects, and here and there, and a little here and there, they're going to go, that's it, they did it, that's what we need. They're going to pull to it. Meanwhile, the calling cards are the books that you've written, as I see it. Those are the things that, even though they may be controversial, they will take some flack. You'll get, people will say, that's the damnedest thing I ever heard, and other people will say, you know, they'll go, it's blasphemy, and the other people will go, man, I never knew that. That's the greatest thing I ever heard. The one thing about that is, at least you get a controversy going enough to raise not only the awareness, but you raise, as you raise the consciousness of the people, whether to, against, or for, you bring the focus. Now, the focus ends up on the author, of course. As a person, not as the Abbey, the good that comes from it, the people that come that go, yes, then you can go, well, look, here's the program. Here's what we got. They'll buy right into it. They bought into the other, they'll buy into that. And it will proliferate itself. As the rest goes down, it comes up.
Okay.
That's kind of how I see it.
I think that's good counsel.
Well, who's your target market?
Anybody that's read Holy Grail.
Right now, my target market is his daughters or my sons.
Well, you don't need a PR firm for that.
You know, I just had to get their attention.
The only thing he needs is a little understanding.
That's
No, but really, you know, if I'm going to lead by example, you know, that's probably about the next step in our family experience, is probably to help these guys find suitable brides and try to keep them close to home and participating with the family endeavor. And so that's probably the first big test of whether we can have an Abbey or not, is that. So that's why we're going to need to have some family discussions along these lines.
You've got a wife, so you can set up the Abbey.
Right.
That's not the problem. Keeping the Abbey rolling down the hill, so to speak, or going.
In other words, you need a certain critical mass of people. Where are they going to come from? It's a real problem. As I know, why you're on recruitment, and I agree, it's the most important thing right now. Where are you going
to
recruit from?
Right. You have to always prime the pump. You got to have something to start with.
You need people in the pipeline.
And usually it's people that you know already that you can talk into it. Now, for instance, the Pfisters are planning on living out here at least for about 6 months. Mm-hmm. This could be a real springboard for them to get on with their own abbeys, their own abbey. Mm-hmm. So this could be a good growing, learning experience for us and having two families out here on the property. But as on a more permanent basis, the way I envision an Abbey working is that usually your sons are, like I said earlier, they start out with their families on your property until they're about 30. And by 30, you'd think they'd have enough capital that they can go out and buy their own homestead nearby, hopefully within a mile, say, of your home site. And then you just begin to seed the community, the area, with your family, and eventually the Abbey becomes a multiplicity of abbeys, and you have an Abbey culture in your area.
Mm-hmm. We kind of only see that with the game and state
where it goes with each other. Yes, farm families sometimes are that way. When sons work the land together, that's the drawback that we have here. We haven't had an opportunity to work the land and make a sustenance from it, but we do have a family business that helps. But then again, I don't expect you boys to be painters all of your life either. I want you to be able to do other things. But regardless, I think we need to be close to the land. Being close to the land, I think, is very important. Anyway, well, we can continue this discussion at the kitchen table. I'll just go ahead and let you all go that want to go. Appreciate your input and for taking the time to listen to me. And I'm going to take this off.
I guess we need some way to reach people who would be interested in it. Find out what what characterizes people that are would be interested in this kind of stuff? Where do they hang out? And advertise in those places. Mm-hmm. Put out an advertisement that would grab their interest.
Well, I mean, yeah, you can advertise, say, for instance, the Backwoods magazine, I think it's called. And Acres USA is kind of a magazine for...
I mean, the 12 tribes, they started off with a core group of 100 people, and now they're at 10,000 people 20 years later, and they're doing something exactly like the Family Abbey, except they don't allow polygamy. In almost every other way, they are, they have your vision.
If they let them come out and build a cabin that they can live on, and let them see the teepee next door, so that they figure, well, I can rough it a little bit, and then they can go on. But there isn't a lot of land around here to expand on right at the moment, but there's enough.
Oh, I think that is, yeah.
If the state would give up that.
There's a bunch of scratches. I think 4:30 would be a good time to start.
Because if I got home and I saw that, I would have just been completely devastated.
That's why I was trying to get you to sit up in that chair so we could hear you better with your input in the discussion. It would be heard on the recorder about
that. Well, that's the thing. I don't speak all day.
Well, you could do enough to justify setting up where we can hear you good.
Because I used the example on the road, the youngest man spoke last.